Good morning.
Good morning.
Join with David and Steve and everyone else in welcoming you here to be with us at Pleasant View. Those that may be visiting, you have a special invitation to come back and hear Tim. I'm a poor substitute, but I'm here and I am grateful for this opportunity to share some thoughts about God's Word with you. Especially appreciate Steve leading that song for us. The song opens with the line, "I would love to tell you what I think of Jesus." And as the song continues, it really paints a picture of a conversation that one might be having with somebody. And that kind of conversation is one that some of us maybe really long for. I'm sure that we've all got friends, we've got loved ones, we've got relatives that we can think of very specifically who don't know God the way they should. And wouldn't we love an opportunity for them to come to us and say, "Hey, I know that you're a Christian, I know you go to church, I know you study. Tell me about Jesus. Tell me what you know about him. Tell me why you worship him, why you go to church, why you dedicate your time to doing what you think he wants you to do. Why is it that you don't do all these things that are lots of fun that we might all enjoy, that I might invite you to come along with me in, and instead you spend time doing what Jesus wants you to do?" And that song goes to tell about what the author might tell. But I want you to spend some time this morning, just a moment, imagining that opportunity. What would you say? What would you tell somebody if they walked up to you, maybe a perfect stranger, or maybe a very dear friend, and said, "Tell me about Jesus. Tell me what you think about him. Tell me what you know about him. Tell me why he's special." I want to spend some time this morning thinking about some characteristics of Jesus and some of the ways in which he is very unique. If we were to take a poll and try to determine which is the most well-known verse in Scripture, it's probably John 3:16, right? And we can all quote it. You're saying it in your head right now. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life." And that tells you how old I am because I learned that in the King James Version. So those that have learned it in a different version may sound different in your head. Sometimes that verse actually gets complicated. It seems very simple on the face of it. But there are a number of ways in which people take that verse and they go this way and they go that way. Just touch on the fact that it says his only begotten Son sometimes causes a little confusion when people are talking about Jesus as being Jesus as the Son of God, because we take that only begotten Son to mean that he has a beginning point, that he was born of God. But the way that that's used in that verse is really talking more about the same way in which we can be sons of Abraham if we act on our belief in God the same way that Abraham did. We can be sons of Abraham in that we are like Abraham in that particular way. Jesus is the only singular individual who can ever be like God in the way that he was. And in that way, he is the only begotten Son. Now, that's a lot more complicated. That's a real quick kind of hitting the high points on it. And we're not really going to spend the time to dig into the depths that we could with that. We've talked about the Trinity and all of that. And it's not a simple concept. But in the way that Jesus shows his uniqueness, in showing us the characteristics of God, Jesus in his life and in the glimpses we get of the way that he interacted with the people around him really did something that no one else can do and no one else has done. And that is, he was able to show the positive aspects of human nature in ways that really took them to their ultimate limit. But at the same time, some of these aspects of human nature we sometimes put in conflict. And you'll see what I'm talking about as we get into this, but I just want you to notice the balance with which Jesus was able to embody these characteristics and the uniqueness that shows. For example, when we think about Jesus, when we talk about Him, one of the things that we might mention in that conversation with our friend is how strong and how powerful and how authoritative Jesus was. And there are lots of examples we could go to, but if you go to Matthew chapter 23, you see Jesus pronouncing what's been called the seven woes upon the Pharisees and the scribes. And there was a lot of contention between those religious leaders and Jesus when he was here on this earth. But as we begin in verse 13 of Matthew 23, he says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. For you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, 'Whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it.' Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." And Jesus goes on. He repeatedly calls them hypocrites. He calls them whitewashed tombs. Lots of other unpleasant things. And this is hardly the picture that many people have of Jesus. A lot of people today would hold him up as the consummate nice guy. The guy who never hurt anybody's feelings. One who was all love. And sunshine and rainbows. But here we see Jesus as a figure of strength and power and authority. We're told of two specific occasions where he got angry. Actually, there are others, but we see his emotion named as anger in Mark chapter 3. When he's dealing with those Pharisees who are constantly criticizing and looking for ways in which they can point out that he's messed up. But when, in this occasion, Mark chapter 3, they put before him a man with a withered hand, and it happens to be the Sabbath, and they're looking for an opportunity to accuse him of working on a day that he's not supposed to work. And he becomes angry with them because they're more concerned about the details of their tradition, of their interpretation of the law that said don't work on the Sabbath, than they are with the fact that this man who had a withered hand, who couldn't work because of it, now can. He's been healed. They don't see the joy in that because they're too busy looking at, aha, you messed up. In anger, points out that that's not the point of that law. And in Mark chapter 10, he becomes angry with his own disciples because in an effort to protect him in their minds, they rebuke the parents who are bringing children to him. He becomes angry and says, no, let the children come to me. And then he uses those children as an example of what they should become if they want to be in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus is not being a nice guy, and he's not calmly explaining what they're doing wrong when he goes into the temple and cleanses it. No, the picture we're given is that of a man who intentionally braided a whip and took it in and overturned the tables and drove them out. A figure of power and strength and authority. And the people recognized that. In Matthew 7, we're told that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes, who argued with themselves about what was more important and which detail really mattered and which one didn't. And this is not as he's rehearsing the Ten Commandments that everybody he's talking to already knows and is already agreeing with him on. No, this is as he's saying, you've heard, don't take vengeance on your enemies, don't hate your... I tell you, do good for them. This is radical teaching as Jesus takes it to the next level, and people recognize in his words the authority that he holds. And you take a moment and you think about all of that, and the description and the picture that paints of Jesus, and it'd be easy to say, that sounds like a guy I could really respect and really look up to, but maybe not a person I want to be around, because I'm not sure I could meet his standards, and I'm not sure he would be happy with me. But as we continue to look at Jesus and other instances in his life, we see his strength, his power, and his authority, but at the same time, we see how kind and how tender and how patient he is with all of those around him. John chapter 11, verse 35, we see Jesus going to visit his friends, Mary and Martha, who have lost their brother. And remember the context of this event. Jesus was made aware that Lazarus was sick, and not just in bed because he didn't feel good. No, Lazarus is at the point of death. His friend is going to die. And Jesus waits 2 days. And then he says to his disciples, okay, let's go visit now, because Lazarus has fallen asleep. And the disciples say, well, if he's asleep, he's going to get better. That's a good sign. And Jesus says, no, Lazarus is dead. And we're going to go demonstrate the power of God. And he goes there knowing what's going to happen. Jesus, again, is unique in his ability to do that. But he goes there understanding what has happened and what's going to happen. And yet, in that moment, when he looks and he sees Lazarus' friends and his sisters mourning the loss, we're told that Jesus wept. This very figure of power and strength and authority, knowing that he could have stopped them from ever feeling this pain, and that in a few moments they're not going to feel this pain anymore, he takes a moment and he shares the pain with them. He wept. Earlier, as he is made aware that his cousin John has been beheaded, he's looking for a place, a quiet time where he can kind of process what's going on and what this means about his ministry and the loss of his friend and his cousin. But he's surrounded by people And we might think, as we picture someone with strength and authority, that this would be the time where we would say, go, I need to be alone. But we're told that he looked at them and he had compassion on them because they were bringing those that were sick and those that needed him. He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so instead of sending them away and taking that time that he needed, one by one, he heals them. As he's leaving Jericho, he's about to enter Jerusalem for the last time. He knows what's ahead. His disciples are saying, you can't go. They're going to kill you, Jesus. He says, it's time. And he's looking at, again, in his ability to see what's coming and to know what's about to happen, there's a multitude of people with him, and they're going to usher him into Jerusalem in what we call the triumphant entry. And he's going to be lauded, and they're going to sing hallelujah as he enters on a donkey, and they're going to lay their coats and they're going to lay palm fronds down. And this is the moment. But as they're leaving Jericho, there's a voice in the crowd. Jesus, Son of David, save me. And there are those who say, hush, now is not the time. But Bartimaeus gets louder and says, Jesus, Son of David, save me. And Jesus stops the multitude and stops everything that's going on in that moment, anticipating the sacrifice that he's about to be. He says, come here. And he heals Bartimaeus. So in balance to his power, and his strength and his authority, we see Jesus showing his kindness, his tenderness, and his gentleness. You see what I'm talking about in exhibiting and demonstrating the positive aspects of human nature in ways that we might find in conflict. We might find it hard to be strong and tender at the same time. But Jesus demonstrated his great ability to be balanced in that. Jesus was also dignified. The dictionary says this: dignity is the state or quality of being worthy of honor or respect. And Jesus, if anyone was worthy of honor and respect. He claimed to be deity, to be God. And there are a lot of people that will tell you, oh, those claims came along later, and they're put in by the translators, and there are a lot of people who later on, after the crucifixion, said, no, Jesus never claimed to be deity. This is all put in after the fact. But take note of the fact that when he was interacting with the Pharisees, in John chapter 14 and verse 6, he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He didn't say, I have the way. I know the way. He said, I am the way. He didn't say, I can tell you the truth. I can describe the life. He said, I am the truth. I am the life. And his original audience, those Pharisees he's talking to, understood exactly what he was saying. As a matter of fact, later on, when he's talking to them in John 8, he tells them, most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. And there was no confusion. They knew exactly what he was saying. Why? How do I know that? Because they reached down and picked up stones to stone him. Why? Because they thought he was guilty of blasphemy, the punishment for which was death by stoning. What blasphemy did he say? He claimed to be God when he said, I am. When he put himself above Abraham. No, he claimed to be God. If anybody was worthy of honor and respect, it was Jesus. But when we use that term dignity, we're usually talking about the way kind of somebody carries themselves. We think that is a dignified person. That is a person who would fit in well in the upper echelons of society. That's a high-class person, a person with great dignity that doesn't allow the ups and downs of this life to affect them. And think about Jesus, even at 12 years old, where is he found? He's not walking home with his parents. When they find him, he's in the temple talking to those religious leaders, those authorities of his day. And we're told he was sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers. At 12 years old, he had great dignity. And he demonstrated that. He was worthy of honor and respect. He demonstrated his dignity from an early age. But in addition to that, on two separate occasions, God the Father himself said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." He earned both the honor and respect of those around him, the men, but he also had the respect of God the Father. And you describe someone with that kind of dignity, that kind of ability to operate in the upper echelons of society, that kind of honor and respect, and it's easy to imagine somebody who had no time for the little guy. But Jesus was the exact opposite of that. One of the criticisms the Pharisees had of Jesus was that he did spend time with the sinners. And the people they didn't approve of. Far from being too occupied with too many important things, Jesus wanted the little children to come to him. And all the instances that we've already talked about his willingness to reach out to the lower class, by their estimation, those people who were not religious authorities, those people who didn't have the honor and respect of the society they lived in. But he never denied who he was. His humility was not the "aw shucks, it was nothing" kind of humility. He never demeaned himself, said, "Oh, it wasn't me, it was this, it was that." No, he owned who he was, but from the beginning of his time on earth, he understood that he was here not to be served, but to serve. As we've said, humility is not thinking less of yourself and deprecating yourself and talking yourself down. That's not humility. Humility is thinking of yourself less. And that all your time and attention is focused on others than yourself. And that describes Jesus. After he fed the 5,000, we're told he departed again to the mountain by himself alone because he perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him a king. Instead of taking a moment and enjoying the fact that people were giving him the honor and respect that he was due, he said, "Now is not the time." So he left instead of enjoying that moment. Later in John chapter 7, his brothers, his physical brothers, Mary's other sons, come to him and say, "If you're really who you say you are, you should be down in Judea. You should be near Jerusalem where the people are going to hear about and see, and you can demonstrate all of this power that you have." They wanted him, or they were encouraging him, to go down and seek fame. Jesus said, "No, it's not time yet." Even among his close friends in this illustration that we've got up here, That moment where Jesus took off his coat, wrapped a towel around himself, and got down and washed their feet. These are his disciples who know him best, who know best that he is who he says he is. And we've studied this moment. You've heard about how people in that day and time, of course, walked around everywhere they went in open sandals, and therefore their feet were not pleasant. They got dirty. And that the job of washing feet was left to the lowest of the servants because it was something nobody wanted to do. As a matter of fact, it seems in this moment that the disciples are perfectly content just to leave it undone. We'd rather have dirty feet, all of us, than any of us be willing to get down and wash feet. Even when Peter objects to Jesus washing his feet, he doesn't say, no, no, let me do that. No, he says, I can't let you, the master, wash my feet. And that exchange continues. But what is Jesus doing in that moment? He's giving us his example of his humility, of his selflessness, of his service. So while, yes, Jesus is worthy of great honor and respect, he is holy, he is equal with God, and we can paint that picture as we describe him to our friend, he's also humble. He is the very picture, the epitome of selflessness. He's a servant. Jesus was also pious. That's a word we don't use very much anymore. The dictionary says piety is the quality of being religious or reverent. It's really kind of taken on a negative connotation because typically, as we might describe someone as being pious, we're talking about someone who takes their religion almost too far. And I think the reason it has a negative connotation is because typically when we're describing someone in this way, we assume an element of hypocrisy. Because surely no one could actually be that good. They may do all the right things and say all the right things, but there's an assumption that it must be for show. But Jesus was that good. He was pious in the best possible way. He was righteous. Jesus, uniquely one of one, he was sinless. He was unapologetically religious. You hear things today about people saying things like, I don't want religion, I want a relationship with Jesus. And many times what they're saying is that all of the details and the boxes we might check, and we get nervous when we hear that, all the things that you say I have to do and avoid, I don't want to focus on those. I just want a friendship with Jesus, whatever that might mean to them often. But that was not the way Jesus practiced his religion. We're told of an instance where he rebuked the Pharisees for their legalism. They were practicing a checkbox religion. We do this, we do this, we do this, we do this, we're good. And Jesus said, no. He said, you tithe your mint and your rue and all manner of herbs, and you pass by justice and the love of God. But what did he say next? He said, these things you ought to have done and not left the other undone. Jesus said, tithing all of your herbs and spices is good. You should do that. Those things are important. But don't miss the point. Jesus never missed the point. The justice and the love of God were of primary importance to Jesus as he did. all of the details. These things you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. And we mentioned in class this morning, when Jesus explained to his disciples how difficult it was for those who had been blessed with this world's goods to remember how much they need God, their reaction was, well, then who can be saved? They seem to be looking at being blessed with this world's goods as an example, an expression of God's approval. So in their minds, they look at someone who was blessed, who was rich, and they say, well, if that person who is enjoying the expression of God's approval, if they are going to find it difficult to be saved, who can be? And Jesus' reaction is fascinating because he doesn't try to correct their misunderstanding. He simply says, yeah, with men, these things are impossible. You cannot reach the standard. But with God, all things are possible. Jesus called them to the highest possible standards. But Jesus was never self-righteous. Jesus was never judgmental on those who came to him. He was pure and sinless, but it never stopped him from loving and working with people involved in all manner of sin. Again, the illustration we have here is that Jesus, when they brought him the woman caught in the very act of adultery, no question of her guilt. Everybody knows exactly what was going on, and everybody knows it was wrong. And in that moment, this man, Jesus, who calls everyone to the highest possible level of obedience, what does he say to her? After the men leave, as he's addressed their concerns, and he's pointed out that everybody knows their sin as well, says, where are your accusers? She says, they've all gone. He says, neither do I accuse you. Go and sin no more. Jesus is able at the same time to live a sinless and pure life and never look down his nose at those who are not capable of doing just that. We're told that even as the Pharisees became angry at his ability to navigate every trap they laid for him, we'll ask him this question, and surely that'll make him choose something. And one of those options that he can, only options he can choose, is going to give us the ability to nail him to the wall with it. Even as they get angry at his ability to navigate those traps, the people were told, the common people heard him gladly. He told the disciples that he came to save the world, not to judge it. And for 14 different occasions, in the New King James anyway, throughout Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we're told that he had compassion. So this man who lived a sinless life, who called everyone to the highest possible standard, didn't do so with judgment. He did it with love. In compassion, over and over again, he forgave the sins of those around him. Even while he's hanging on the cross, he says, Lord, forgive them. Forgive them. They're at that moment calling for his life. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Jesus is able to show us both ends of the spectrum in a beautiful, balanced way. So as we describe Jesus to our friend in our hypothetical scenario, where they came to us and said, tell me about Jesus. He was good in every possible way. This week we went up to one of the colleges Charlie is looking at. And they were giving a presentation from some of their professors and some of their students, and one of the professors was asked about his teaching philosophy. And he said, I have this picture in my head every time I get up in front of class that there's this flashing neon sign over my head that says, so what? Who cares? What does this mean to me? And I thought, that's a great thing to have in mind when you're teaching English to college-age kids who don't really care how to structure a sentence in a paragraph, but need to know it. So I thought I'd kind of wrap this up in a way that we can take it with us as we go this morning. What does it mean to us that Jesus was able to show us these positive aspects of human nature in every extreme and ultimate way, but also in beautiful balance? First and foremost, it reminds us of his origin. As we've said about Jesus many times, he is the only, he is the unique, he is the one of one, he is the exclusive who was able to do this. To always only be good, even when showing anger and frustration. That's not normal, in case you were wondering. That's not something I'm capable of. Anytime I feel like I might be leaning in a way that is positive, I have to be very careful that I'm not leaving something else undone or losing another positive aspect. Only the divine could do what Jesus did. It's evidence that he is the Son of God, that he was able to show us all of this. It also reminds us that in his perfection, that is the pure and sinless life that was given for us. Because I'm not capable of being pleasing to God without his grace and his mercy, which only comes to us through the willing sacrifice of the one who was capable of living in such a way that God himself was able to say, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. And that is the life that was given. And we will be judged based on how we respond to that gift. And when we come to know of that gift, we have a decision to make. How are we going to respond to the perfect life that was given to us? Are we going to believe, based on this evidence and lots of other evidence, that he is the Son of God? Are we going to turn away from those things that displease him and do what we can to please him? Are we going to repent from sin and turn to him? Are we going to submit to the element that he asked us to do, and that is to be baptized? And when we do, the other thing that this study of the positive aspects of the character of Jesus does is it reminds us that we are called to be like him. And I don't know about you, but I'm struck with the impact of that. Because as we've talked about all these things this morning, what have we said? That I can't do that. That I might at times be strong, but in those times I struggle with also being tender. That I might at times be able to be authoritative in a presentation about God's word, but that I have to be very careful that I don't leave kindness and generosity out when I'm in those moments. Jesus was able to find that balance. And that is what we are called to do. And if that doesn't challenge you, then I challenge you to think a little bit more about what you're contemplating. I hope this week somebody comes to you and says, tell me about Jesus. I hope somebody comes to me. I pray for those opportunities. But I also pray for the strength and the wisdom to take advantage of those opportunities when they become available. Because the balance that Jesus showed is what I am called to show. If you find yourself in need of help with that, that is what we are here for. Not that any of us can achieve it. But if you need special help, if you need any help, if you need any prayer, we'd love to serve you in that way. If you'd like to come as we stand and sing.